Greetings, humans. It's time for another edition of the Sensitive Skin Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. And today's guest is somebody who I have never actually spoken to before, never met, although I find that hard to believe because we knew like a million people in common. And that guest, her name is Puma Pearl. She's a fixture on the Lower East Side, and I mean that in a good way. And she's a poet, and she hosts quarterly parties called the Puma Pearl Pandemonium. And we got into some good stuff. It was interesting. She was hanging around in a lot of the same places I was in the 80s, but she was there in the 70s, and she knew a lot of the same people that I do. I was very interested, and I was so interested that I'm so stupid, I kind of missed it the first time she said it, and I got it the second time she said it, because it just like didn't kind of compute. But the father of her child, or one of her kids anyways, Eddie Pinero, who is Miguel Pinero's younger brother, the great Puerto Rican poet and miscreant, Miguel Pinero. And she hung around with, we talked about Miguel, and then we were talking about all the old people at the New Yorican and Neither Nor and all that stuff, and Rick Van Valkenburg and Bimbo Rivas and Pedro Pietri. We spoke a little bit about Martin Wong, and it's kind of funny. Apparently Martin Wong was obsessed with, Mikey Pinero's work, and, Puma would sometimes create fake Mikey poems and sell them to Martin for use in his paintings. How's that for some art history? Because Martin is, he's become recognized as a quote-unquote important painter. He's all over the place. He's had an amazing painting in SF MoMA, and he's in the Met in New York and all over the place. Anyway, at around the 41-minute mark, Puma will read us some poems. This one came out a little short, and I'm afraid I had to edit it for, let's just say, traditional reasons. There was some stuff that is probably better left on the cutting room floor. And of course, as always, that was the best stuff. But at any rate, this is still, I think we had a good conversation. It was good to finally speak to her because, again, I can't imagine that we haven't met each other at some point in the past. But it seemed like it was the first time. So anyway, here's my conversation with the delightful and talented Puma Pearl. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. I don't know. You know, it's been kind of a weird summer. I didn't want to do this last week because I felt like all we're going to do is talk about Steve Dalachinsky.
Yeah.
And it's still kind of, you know, it's still here, you know, I was at the book fair with my publishers from Great Weather, who published my last book, and they published his last book, and everybody was stopping by to talk, and I guess it's something, you know, we all share this.
Yeah, yeah, it's very, very sad and shocking news. I mean, I'd almost forgotten about this. He had some kind of health scare like 6 months ago and was in the hospital for a few days, and I didn't really know about that, but I saw him last just about a year ago when he was out in San Francisco to do some readings, and he was, you know, just really energetic and, you know, doing his thing, going around from one reading to another, and just didn't seem like he was going to be the next to go.
I was feeling like something was imminent. It's just, you know, it's tough when it's people that just leave a huge hole in the world, you know, really unique and not replaceable. On the other hand, his last words to Yuka were, maybe I overdosed on Sun Ra.
Yeah.
So
I'd heard that. That's pretty awesome.
Right? Yep. So I really sort of picture him like just whizzing around the universe and meeting up with so many others wherever they are, and we're all writing poems, and we're all thinking about it. So, you know, it's not. It's I hope it doesn't sound insensitive, right, to say it's not the worst way to go. You know.
No, it's. I mean, we all got to go sometime. So, I mean, one thing that that struck me though was two things I guess that are kind of related was first was the massive outpouring of love and affection and respect that like I saw like through Facebook, through emails, phone calls. I mean, the guy was so widely loved and admired, and I was thinking, I wonder if he knew that. Probably he didn't, you know, we're all artists full of self crippling yeah. self-doubt and, you know, it would have been nice if he could have seen that before he left. And by the same token, the fact that I was really, it sounds strange to say, I was so happy to see that his obituary made the New York Times. And how much would he have loved that, you know?
Yeah.
And again, it's sad.
He would have loved that, except he would, yeah. But the thing I didn't like about that article is that after really exploring the fact that he didn't like to be labeled, they said Steve Dalachinsky, avant-garde poet, and I know he would have been pissy about that.
Yeah, yeah, well, that was Steve. He was always pissy about something. Or, you know.
Exactly, like my friend Amy, who's here, I don't know if you know her, she said he was really like brilliant at finding whatever the downside of the situation was. But, you know,
Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, when I had first met him, whenever that was, I made the mistake of introducing him to someone as a jazz poet, and like I never did that again, you know. And I've been like, yeah, like I totally understood why he didn't like it. And people are constantly like introducing me or even writing in bios calling me a punk poet, and I can't stand it.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
You know, nobody... a punk poet or a street poet or a Lower East Side poet. But the punk poet thing, it doesn't even make any sense, because anyone who reads what I'm writing, I'm not, like people will make that assumption because of my age or sensibility or who my friends are. But in actuality, I was on the Lower East Side during that whole era, and I was really up to, like, other activities and not doing them in cool places, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
so it's really a regret to me that I actually missed the heart of that scene. So whenever anyone introduces me that way, writes about me that way, I feel like it's making me sound like a poser, you know?
So what were you doing back in those days? Back in the, like what, 70s, 80s?
Yeah, well, I first of all, I had a nasty heroin habit for a good period of that time, and when I had started on the Lower East Side, let's say I moved into the Lower East Side before that whole punk era, you know.
Uh-huh.
I was coming down here since I was like a kid, really, and I lived down here sort of as part of the community. In fact, there was a time where you probably couldn't even tell me I wasn't Puerto Rican, you know. And I mean, I was very, very enmeshed in this community, you know. So it doesn't mean I didn't pass through any of the places, but it's a funny thing how just a few months or a year can make a total difference, or maybe like where you live. If you live one block east or one block west, and I don't think that's as true anymore, but it could make an entire difference of where you went.
Yeah.
You know, like I was living on 7th Street near Avenue B when the New Eureka Poets Cafe opened. On 6th Street, before it was on 3rd Street. And I was there so much that my child's father is the bartender, actually. It was Miguel Pinheiro's younger brother, Eddie Pinheiro, is my daughter's father.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yes. And years later, my daughter hosted slams in open rooms at the cafe, like when she was in high school, when they had already moved to 3rd Street.
What is your daughter's name?
If I had been Julia Gomez, she's not into writing anymore.
Uh-huh.
But she, yeah, but she, you know, she had like huge stage fright as a poet, but not as a host. She was like a great host. Yeah. I'll tell you just a quick funny story about it. She told me when she was in her last year of high school, and it was about March, and she said that if she didn't get on, she decided to be a poet, and if she didn't get on the poetry circuit by August, she was joining the Marines. And I was like, oh, fuck, you know?
It's one extreme to another.
And the reason why she was joining the Marines wasn't out of patriotism. It was because she knew that I would not be able to afford to send her to a really good school, and she didn't have the grades for scholarships, and she believed all that stuff, you know what I mean? That Sarah, she really, you know, she really bought into it. And I'm thinking, oh God, like another young person of color sees the military as an out. And I was feeling like a terrible failure because what she said is was true. I did not have the ability to send her to a great school, even though she wound up graduating from Brooklyn College with honors, which is a good school. But anyway, she's saying she's going to get on the if she doesn't get on the poetry circuit by August. And I had been out of that whole circuit. I'd gotten clean. I'd gotten jobs. I'd gone to school, you know. I have an older kid, too. I had, you know, tried to make amends in my life, that whole kind of thing. And I just couldn't imagine that you could be, like, known in the poetry world in a couple of months. So she took herself down to the cafe, because when she was like 3 years old, she read her first poem there, and they completely embraced her, you know. I mean, she knew Algarin since she was born. She knew Pedro Pietri since she was born, you know. She knew Lucky Cienfuegos, who was not with us anymore, and like in a minute, she was in the middle of it all, you know. So thank God, I really credit the cafe that even though she didn't stay in the poetry world, thank God for them. She didn't join the Marines, and I was thinking that she knew that she could go somewhere and be a poet and be an artist.
Let's back up for a minute though. So you grew up in the New York area.
I grew up in Brooklyn.
Okay. And so you started hanging out of the Lower East Side and got involved in all the extracurricular activities available.
let's say both negative and positive.
Right, yeah.
You know?
There's always a negative and a positive. There's nothing binary in this world, right?
Yeah. I mean, there was an amazing cultural scene going on in the New Eureka movement, like before the punk movement, like with Bimbo Rivas and the Parks always had Latin music. And I don't know if you were here when there were Tuesday night shows in Tompkins Square Park. We still had the band shell.
Yeah.
It was so alive and it was so vibrant. This is before they came in, like, from Soho and shit with art galleries.
Yeah, yeah.
This is when, you know, the art was, like, really, really in the street. And a few years before, like, you know, I mentioned I also have a son. And my son's father, he was part of the Motherfuckers. I don't know if you know
them.
Or, right, yeah. So that was, like a kind of pre-punk kind of, you know what I mean? Like, there was no word for it. We didn't kind of come down here drawn by music or culture. It was just a bunch of misfits who had nowhere else to be.
Okay, now wait a second. You're tickling some old neurons of mine. I haven't heard or thought about the Motherfuckers in a long time. Now, weren't they, correct me if I'm wrong, were they the guys who ran the drug spot, the laundromat?
Oh, no. These are a bunch of anarchists.
Oh, okay. Okay.
They took over the Fillmore when the MC5 played.
That was them.
Yeah, with the free. Oh my God, no. They had free stores and.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking of the gang that ran that drug spot for like 50 years or something like that. You know.
Well, I do know the laundromat. Yeah.
The laundromat. Everybody knows the laundromat. Yeah. And you go there and get a cheeseburger, you know. But I'd heard sometime that that family that was a family-run business that started in like 1947 and had been there. Like, it was there for like 50 years before the feds finally came in and shut everything down in the mid-90s.
Well, most of it was families. Like if you remember Laredo on 10th Street, I mean, they were all families that were running all of these drug spots, and then there was like the big money behind them. But everybody it was all family businesses because people didn't have that many ways to make money.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. I no judgment.
Yeah.
I just thought it was kind of interesting the fact that like that somebody could do something like that for decades on end. I thought was kind of fascinating.
And you're actually from New York, right?
I grew up outside of Providence, Rhode Island, and and moved to the Lower East Side when I got out of college, which was like 80. I moved into the Lower East Side in 84. So I never hung out at the old New Yorkerican. I hung out at the Third Street location all the time.
Did you?
Yeah. So it's funny that we've never met.
Funny.
Or maybe we have. Yeah. Maybe we have and just don't remember. That's also entirely.
We probably have.
Yeah, we probably have.
Yeah,
I used to hang out at. Neither Nor. Remember Neither Nor on 6th Street between C and D?
Are you kidding? I have lived in that place.
Oh, okay.
We had to have known each other.
So I knew Rick really well.
I slept in the back. Oh,
okay, so
you're
back there with Mikey?
Yeah. Mikey, well, he was my brother-in-law.
Miguel Pinero
was my brother-in-law.
Oh,
yeah,
my daughter's
father was Eddie Pinero, who was the bartender.
I thought you said it was Miguel Algarin was.
No.
Oh,
yeah,
it was Mikey.
It was Pinero. Yeah.
I was actually quite friendly with Mikey for some reason. I don't know why. He took me under his wing.
He would do that.
Yeah, he only robbed me at gunpoint once.
Well, you got away pretty easy.
I guess it's pretty. I mean, it's a long story that I've written about, but yeah, he. You know, robbed me at gunpoint, and then I saw him like a week later. I was walking down the street, and he's like, buddy, come here. And I was like, whoa, I don't know. And he's like, no, it's cool. And he's like holding up a $10 bill, and he's like, I got your money back for you, man. It's like, so he was like, I just sold my life rights to Michael Mann for $200,000. So here's your $10 back. And I was like,
yeah.
Huh. So I guess you just borrowed it or something. But yeah.
Right. I'd borrow it at gunpoint. Yeah. Well, I could tell you stories, but I won't. But one thing Miguel Algarin has said was when Mikey had money, everybody had money. When Mikey had no money, nobody had money.
Yeah. That sounds
about right. That about sums it up.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you one thing. If he did one good thing in my life, because he really didn't do any good things in my life, but if he did one good thing in my life, I've in my life like lost all my writing and all my art like more than once.
Mm-hmm.
And at this particular time, I was like getting evicted through another apartment, and I very assiduously, no, that's not the right word, but I painstakingly had packed up all my writing and all my poetry and all my stories and all my artwork from when I used to draw, and I had taken it to Martin Wong's house. Do you remember the artist, mm-hmm. Martin Wong? I took it to Martin Wong's house. He lived in the 6th floor walk up on Ridge Street for him to keep for me because I knew that I lose everything, you know?
Right.
And then I took it back. Don't ask me why, right before I was going to leave this apartment, because I made some type of deal with the landlord that instead of being evicted, I would leave by a certain time. And the apartment looked like 29 hoarders lived there, because like I used to sell shit on the street all the time, and it was just like an insane thing to even walk into. So somehow I left those boxes behind of the writing, and we didn't have computers then.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'd had one, I'm sure I would have sold it anyway, but what you had was on paper, probably one copy, unless you were published like Mikey, because I remember when he used to do readings, someone would have to go steal one of his books from the St. Mark's bookshop, because he never had anything, So I also used to write poems like in what I thought was his voice and sell them to people who are obsessed with them. But that's another story.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I left everything behind, and I saw Mikey, and I told him, oh, I left everything. I lost all my shit. And he just looked at me like it was nothing, and he went, write some more.
Yeah, there you go.
And there you go.
It's funny. Somebody, Martin Wong's name came up a couple of years ago, and someone asked me if I knew him. And I said, I don't think so. And then they didn't believe that I didn't know him. So it's like, okay, maybe I did. But anyway, I was at, I went with my daughter to SF MoMA last week.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through the whole museum from top to bottom. And then the very bottom floor, we're going through their permanent collection. And they have this permanent collection of like 20th century people, and there was just like a shitload of Matisses, which is like, wow, why did somebody have like 30 Matisses that they gave? Anyway, last painting I see in the museum is a Martin Wong, because he was originally from San Francisco, and I was like,
yeah,
and I just looked at this painting, and I was just like blown the fuck away. I was like, holy this is the best fucking painting in this whole museum. I just seen every other painting and walked all the way around, and his was like the last one in the permanent collection of San Francisco artists. And really amazing, amazing stuff.
Well, he was brilliant. He was also obsessed with Mikey, and he used to put him in quite a few of his paintings, because he used to love to do these paintings like of tenements and with people looking out of every window. And one, he was also obsessed with firemen. Mm-hmm. So he would always... He also used some of his poetry and paid him well for it in some of the paintings, which are hanging in the Met.
Hmm.
You know, one of them was hanging in the Met. So, yeah, Martin Wong was actually like somebody who bought the poems that weren't really Mikey's. I guess I could tell that story.
That's what you were alluding to a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah, how many people who are obsessed with them, yeah.
Fugazi Mikey poems.
So, yeah, you know. But
if they were good enough to pass, they're good enough, right? I mean, what the heck?
I get. Well, not all Mikey's poems were all that good either. Some were good, some weren't. Some
my pretend ones were
probably some of his worst ones, you know?
Yeah.
But all you needed was the voice, you know?
Yeah, but
like
I mean,
one time I went to a Martin Wong retrospective at the New Museum, maybe 1992 or something, and it included a filmed interview with him, and he was talking about his obsession with like the seedy side of things and following people into shooting galleries in this really fucked up apartment with fucked up people. He used to go hang out in on 3rd Street, and I was like, oh shit, that was my apartment. He's talking about me right now. You know, the security guards passed. I said, look at this, he's talking about me.
Yeah, 3rd. I remember the whole Lower East Side. There were like various spots you could go to. Let's say various places were more dangerous than others. But 3rd Street between C and D was like the Wild West. And I remember you'd hear gunshots there almost every night. There was something going on, and I was afraid to go there. Unless Mikey took me.
Well, that's how he made his money. That's why I was too stupid to be afraid of anything. So
yeah.
I was just fine going anywhere, you know.
Yeah.
I look back at it now. Like it's amazing. Like that much ever happened to me, if you want to know the truth. I was more, you know, part of the thing I was saying, like, before, like, I was on 7th Street, so I went to the New Eureka. And if I had been on 2nd Street, I would have gone to CB's every night, I'm sure. But I was much more wary about walking around the Bowery than I was about walking around Avenue C. I had done it for so many years, you know?
Yeah, it's true. It's like whatever you're used to, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I remember a couple of times Mikey intercepted me and said, where are you going? Don't go over there, man. That's garbage. Come with me. And he'd bring me down to 3rd Street and... There would be, like, you know, people looking at me like oh, look, here's some fresh pickings. And Michael, this is Buddy. He's cool, man. Leave him alone. Of course, Mikey was like the mayor of the Lower East Side. So,
You know. Well, everybody either would respect him or want to kill him. There were no two ways, you know.
Or both. Yeah. I think there's a lot of people who felt both.
Yeah, or both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he ended up, it was interesting. I went to places where I probably would not have survived going if I wasn't in his company.
Yeah.
And I almost didn't survive being in his company.
Those were crazy days.
Those were crazy.
Really like it. Yeah.
Crazy days, for sure. Yeah. Like the, what's the Rutger Hauer line from Blade Runner? If you could see what I've seen with these eyes.
Right. I always think of Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now. The horror.
Or Dennis Hopper in Apocalypse Now.
I
tell people that's basically what I was like in 1986. So, and these days you're doing the Puma Pearl Pandemonium. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I've actually been doing that for 7 years. I always kid around when I open it. And like when it's an anniversary, I celebrate another anniversary of my longest relationship to date, you know. So it started like seven years ago at the Barry Electric. They had started this happy hour and they had wanted to start using this room that had been a VIP room. And they asked me, well, would you do a couple of poems? And I said, well, you know, that sounds boring. Why don't I have a little music with it? And it became this quarterly thing that I could do it more than quarterly, but doing it quarterly has made it an event, you know?
That's cool. So when's the next one coming up soon?
The next one will be January 17th. I just did one September 20th. I always do it and call it my birthday bash just to get more people.
Right.
In fact,
right.
I think
I was like wondering about that. Yeah, it's Puma's birthday bash. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
like
that's
really
a good trick. I like it.
Yeah, it seems to get more people. I don't know.
And maybe you could even just say it's Puma's 50th birthday bash, you know, to really get them excited.
We could call it whatever we want.
Yeah.
But yeah, so and it also comes at the same time as the anniversary of the show. Mm-hmm. And there are always a few other people who have birthdays that day, like one of my featured readers. Like my birthday had been earlier in the week, but one of my featured readers who would come from Kansas City, her birthday happened to be that day. Another guy traveling from Ohio, his birthday was 2 days before. So, you know, I'm able to get like a lot of people have come from a lot of distances, you know, to do the show. And I like being able to bring people that you don't see around. And I think, you know, I had started doing my poetry like opening for bands. I didn't have my band yet when we first, it was all kind of coming together when I did that first Pandemonium. But I felt like if there's one thing I could say that I helped to bring, and obviously I'm not the only one who does this, but I helped to bring poetry to people who thought they didn't like poetry.
Yeah, that's great because, I think there's I was talking about this with someone else recently, is that people generally like poetry, you know, if they're exposed to it and if they're exposed to quote-unquote good or relevant poetry. People, because I mean, people, what is popular music if not, you know, good popular music is poetry set to music, right? I mean,
or they're actual poets like Patti Smith, Richard Hell, Bob Dylan, you know. In fact, I just saw an interview with Patti Smith where she could finally be the artist she started out to be, like saying like she became a rock star by accident,
right,
you know,
right.
Like we should all be that lucky, right?
Yeah.
But, you know,
and Richard Hell too. Richard Hell was a poet, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I know that if I, Patti just stuck with it. There's a lot of people who've done really well who stuck with it. And, you know, I read my first poem, I think, at the St. Mark's Poetry Project, my first and almost last time, because they never asked me to read. I have the same resentment Dalachinsky had. But, you know, Patti Smith started around that time.
Right.
She started, like, just with Lenny by kind of accident putting it together. And all these years later, I finally, like, stuck with it. And I also started with musicians kind of accidentally. Like, there was, like, a slot. It was, like, a benefit for Hurricane Sandy. And I was asked to do some poems and just wound up doing it with a band. And we said, you know what, I think we have something here. I think we should, like, keep doing this, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm still doing it with one of the St. Geoff Wilson is, like, playing, has been with me all of these years, you know. So it's the same kind of thing. And it's too bad I didn't do this, like, 40 years earlier or whatever when Patty did, but, you know.
Yeah, well, whatever. Better late than never.
It didn't happen that way, so.
Yeah, it didn't happen that way. But, yeah, yeah. I think of a number. John S. Hall started the same way, right?
Yeah.
And then he became a rock star for a minute with King Missile. And
and he still has King Missile in a couple of other bands.
He's still going around. Yeah, yeah, it's great.
He's done my Pandemonium. John's great.
Okay. So did you know Ferris? You must have known Ferris.
I didn't. I know of him, but I didn't know him.
Oh, okay. That's another thing that's funny.
Yeah.
I mean, that was my crew at Neither Nor. It was like John Ferris and Norman Douglas and
I knew he was there, but I don't remember. I was in the back, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But I was very friendly with Billy Bang.
Mm-hmm. I remember. Yeah, I knew Billy a little bit.
Yeah, I was close with Billy Bang. I knew Butch Morris. Mm-hmm. I knew a lot of the musicians.
Right.
I mean, so many people went in and out of there. Are you talking about when they moved further down between C and D, not where Rick started it at B? Do you remember the corner where?
No,
Rick
I didn't know it. Back, I didn't know it back then. I knew it on Sixth Street. And where Dennis
was originally just a little bookstore. There was, like, no room for performances or anything.
Yeah. And then and Dennis Hirone was living upstairs. Did you know Dennis?
Yes.
Yes.
I did.
Is he still around?
Yes. I don't know if he's still around.
Yeah, I've asked people. Nobody seems to know.
I don't know. I haven't seen him or Mikalaya in all of these years. I remember my daughter and their kid, like, jumping up and down on the, there was a pastor, there was a church right there, like a really religious church.
Uh-huh.
And I remember going out, and my daughter and their kid, whose name was Denny, were jumping
right,
up and
Denny,
down on the
yeah.
roof of the van. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember him. I would go over there, he was always watching Married with Children. That's what I somehow remember.
Yeah. Really funny. Yeah.
And he was always hanging out with Butch Morris's kid.
Yes, yes. And Billy Bang, he had two kids also, I think. He had a girl and a boy. I was pregnant at the same time as his wife, Josie, twice.
Uh-huh.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of people
we must have, like, brushed up against each other a million times without...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
Funny, because not a lot of people bring up Neither Nor. And I ran into Rick, you know, he had a twin brother who died.
Right, right.
And I ran into him, I believe it was the premiere of the Pinheiro film, or one of the showings, that film where Benjamin Bratt played Mikey.
Yeah,
somehow
didn't work for me, that movie.
No, of course not.
And first of all, the fact that he was a foot taller.
I was actually on the set, yeah.
Yeah.
They had asked me to come to the set, and I didn't want to because I really hated the whole thing, but I did. I was on the set of it for a minute, but I wasn't in it. Like, the family, the sisters and stuff, they were all extras, and I didn't want to be in it. I mean, it was a whole family fight behind the scenes on the whole thing. I didn't really want to be involved in it, but I did go with them to one of the openings. There were like a few openings, and I ran into Rick. I hadn't seen him in many years when we exchanged contact information, and he actually came down to one of my shows.
And does he still live in New York?
Yeah, he lives up in Inwood or Washington Heights around there. Yeah, he's somewhat involved in a bookstore called Word Up, and he's still with the same woman he married way back then. There was a woman he was with, she was an opera singer.
Hmm.
And they've been together, like, all of this time. I think they're kids, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny, because that brings you back to what I was going to say. We're talking about poetry, and I think that, like, a lot of people... if they're exposed to poetry, find out they love it, as opposed to opera, which
yeah, that's true. Not everyone's going to get opera's into opera. Although it also depends how it's presented.
I guess. I mean, I have to say, I mean, if I hear Renee Fleming doing an aria, my heart can melt. But, you know, I actually went to the opera for the first time in my life a couple of years ago. And it was very relaxing. I'll put it to you that way.
Well, I've still never been to the Met, but I used to sometimes go to the Amato Theater Company on the Bowery.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was such a beautiful little opera house. I used to like to go there. But I think with poetry, I think the reason, like, people think they don't like it is the way it was shoved down people's throats. Like,
right.
Like, I always think of the poem. They would make us memorize shit. You know, I mean, how are you not going to hate something that you have to memorize?
Yeah, I don't know. It depends. I mean, the Russians do that, you know, the Russians who like love poetry more than anybody. They all memorize dozens of poems. And I think it's just maybe it's the way we're taught to memorize them or something.
No, I think it's the content.
Or maybe it's the content.
Russians are all emotional and depressed. And, you know, it would work for them. But we were like, they were not giving us anything that was relevant to us. It was like this, and maybe it's different now. It may be very different now because now there are so many, at least in New York, I don't know how it is the rest of the country, but there are a lot of cool poets who have residencies in the school system.
I remember when I was in grade school, they wanted to teach us about poetry, so they played the record of that you've probably heard of Sebastian Cabot reading, you know, "It Ain't Me, Babe," the Bob Dylan.
Oh yeah! So, oh my god! Yeah.
Which is just fucking hilarious, you know. But we were taught like this is poetry, and you should listen to this guy. Here, this guy Bob Dylan, he's not just some pop star or whatever. He's being read by Sebastian Cabot.
Oh my God, that's like William Shatner doing Mr. Tambourine.
It's basically and, on the there's albums that put those two together, I believe. You know the.
Yeah, but what I remember is Joyce Kilmer's Trees, Man Is an Island, and In Flanders Field, and they're all about death. Every one of them, you know.
Yeah.
And Flanders Fields, the poppies grow, you know, and Beowulf and being made to memorize old English.
Yeah.
And they put away their silver sota. I still remember some of it, you know. So the stuff they were shoving down our throats was really very appealing to us.
They made us read the Canterbury Tales, you know.
Oh, yeah, the Canterbury. I actually kind of like
it. Well, it's kind of great because is it the Miller's Tale, the one that's like completely filthy?
The Miller's Tale,
exactly.
Yeah. I think they didn't realize how subversive they were being with that one. So I think kids have the opportunity for it to be different now. Although I'm sure it's not happening in every single school. You know?
I mean, for me, it was when I went to college and just took some English classes and for shits and giggles. And I was exposed to, you know, and whatever it was just about the right time where, I mean, the beats were so ignored academically for so many years. And when I went to college, it was just when they were starting to be somewhat respectable again. And I had a teacher, and we did Ginsberg and Corso, and I was like, well, okay, this is, I can get behind this, you know.
I mean that's legitimate now, and there's a million different types of courses you could take now at school. Where did you go to college?
I went to Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it was
I didn't go to college at the age where I, you know, it would have been normal to go to college then.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But yeah, my English teacher was like an old beat hippie, this woman. I don't remember her name, but you know, she wore a beret and everything, you know.
Even a beret. Oh my god, and black tights.
Yeah, it's funny. It's just like, and that, I mean, I probably read Kerouac when I was in high school, but it was really just like somehow there was this massive push around that time about the beats, and everybody was reading Naked Lunch, and is.
Well, I do have I have one shelf on my I was I've been involved in this project the last 2 days of reorganizing my books, so you can imagine what that's like. But I do have one shelf that's all my original City Lights books that I bought at the 8th Street bookstore when I was like in high school. I was fascinated with them, and I think like if there's one writer that really, really made a difference to me and told me that, you know, it was actually possible for me to be something other than stuck in Brooklyn, it was Diane Zaprima, you know. And I mean, she was from Brooklyn. She's from Italian neighborhood. Of course, I didn't realize that she was from a completely different Brooklyn than I was, because Carol Gorenz is very different than Gravesend. And like she had artists and musicians in her family, and they actually believed in art. But I didn't know any of that part. You know what I mean? All I knew was like, you know, she left home. She wrote that book, Memoirs of a Beatnik. Did you ever read that? And dinner and not dinners. I still have my original copy of like Revolutionary Letters and Dinners and Nightmares. They're completely falling apart. I had to buy like new copies that you can read. But you know,
Now,
so that was big example to
is
me.
it Diane De Prima, or is it, I don't know, is it Joyce Johnson, or who, or is it Hattie, who's still living on like Third Avenue, and they wouldn't, she refused to sell her house, and they had to build that stupid luxury hotel kind of around her house. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think it was Hetty.
Yeah, it was Hattie. Yeah,
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 yeah, yeah.
yeah.
I do know what you're talking about.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I thought that was awesome. They
Yeah.
were just
Yeah.
offering her just bags and bags of money, and she's like, "Nope, not interested." And they built the
And
hotel
Hetty is,
literally
yeah.
over her house. It's yeah.
And Hetty's still around. I
Oh,
mean,
she is
she
great.
really, yeah. I see her quite regularly. We're on the same bills a lot at the Howl Gallery at Howl Happening.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, who runs Howl? I've heard so much about it the last few years. And
Well, you know, it was a legacy of a tourist, of a tour of Vegas,
oh, okay.
and Jane Friedman was the executor, and that was how they opened Howl. So Jane is the exec. You know who I mean, Jane, by Jane Friedman, right? So she is the executive director, and then Ted from the Antagonist, he does a lot of the events, and they have a great staff going on. And Bob Holman is on the board of directors,
Oh,
and
he is. Okay.
a bunch of other. Yeah,
Yeah.
he's very involved in it. So
Yeah.
yeah, it's really a great space, you know, and
Yeah.
it's so open to the community. I've done a number of events there, and they've really kind of like adopted me as even though like I'm younger than like the Beat Movement. They put me on those bills with Ed Sanders and Ann Waldman
Oh,
and
cool.
Hetty and Eileen Miles, you know. Yeah, it's like really cool. We've done like
Yeah.
tributes to Ferlinghetti, Allen Ginsberg. We're doing one to Kerouac soon, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, I should get in touch with them, because I'd actually like to do an event with them this fall for the anthology release. Have some kind of party there. I was thinking that would be
You
a good place to
totally
do it.
should.
Yeah.
Yeah,
The anthology that
absolutely.
you're
That.
in, you,
Yes,
Puma
I
Pearl, are
know.
in the anthology.
I was very excited that I was in the anthology,
Yeah.
because you know, I wasn't even that I was, you know, you that you chose to put me in it. You know, I didn't even like, you know, answer a submission call. So I've never been able to figure sensitive skin out. I've had a story in it and a poem in it, both through Ron Colm. But I mean, figure it out. But I've never seen like a submission calls actually. So it was because of Ron that I've had work in it.
Yeah,
You know.
we've been fortunate so far as that we've never done submission calls.
That's great.
Yeah, we usually get a there's people like Ron and a couple other people like that who are out there and guiding people our way. And you know, once in a while something comes across the transom that's good, but just seems to be expanding slowly. Just the reach, meeting more and more people, and you know.
Yeah, well, right. Yeah, well, no, it has a pretty good reach, I think, on social media. And Ron is great at
Yeah.
promoting people and bringing people together,
Absolutely.
and you know, taking
We
his
love
stuff
you,
to
Ron.
he
We
takes
love you.
stuff. Yeah, yes, Ron. And I love his Jill and Duke stories too.
Oh,
Those are
yeah.
some great, Lower East Side stories.
Absolutely. Yeah. I remember reading those like years before I met him. But yeah, I love, again, I love his energy, and I just love the way he's promotes so many people.
He really does. He
Yeah.
really goes out of his way.
Yeah.
In fact, I have to have him read sometime. I haven't gotten to him
Yeah.
yet. It's because when you do something quarterly, it's hard to get, reach everybody that you would like to, because
Yeah.
it only happens once in a while. And in fact, I'm so glad that I finally did put Steve Dalachinsky on in June, that I finally did get around to him, or he'd be haunting me,
Yeah. Well, we've come full circle. Going back
Okay.
to Steve,
Yeah.
do you want to read a few poems for us?
Okay. Let's see what we have here. Well, we've been talking about Steve, so I just want to read. I wrote this just as a very short toast for him at my last pandemonium, and I read it, and it's called Jazz Into the Unknown.
Okay.
What can you say about a man whose last words to his wife Yuko were, "Maybe I overdosed on Sunra"? To write much more would be an intrusion on his ongoing conversation with the universe. So what do? You play Monk and Coltrane and listen to the space between the notes. Steve's birthday is coming up soon. I remember a reply to a message I sent. "Thanks, Puma," he wrote, "jazzing into the unknown." Thinking of Steve, we move closer together and closer to the sun. And if we're lucky, maybe we'll do a little jazzing into the unknown, just like Steve's doing. Okay, so here is another one. This is called The Taste of Rebellion. What did your rebellion taste like? Mine tasted like long-haired boys, sounded like 4 a.m. rock and roll, felt like the bottom of my mother's staircase after she kicked me out for coming home too late. My rebellion tasted of not going back, smelled like $34 in my wallet, dug into me like the knife resting in a sheath on my hip the day I changed my name to Puma, just like my knife. My rebellion felt like never going home. When I walked down that street, sensations began in my legs, exploded like orgasms I'd never even had yet, smelled like pot and silk scarves burning shade on light bulbs, looked like paisley, red and blues melting on purple, sounded like Jimmy and Janis before they reached 27 and draped the Fillmore in black. Nobody witnessed my rebellion. Everybody caught up in their own. My family had already labeled me crazy, hopeless, a lost cause, a loser nobody would love. They were right and they were wrong. His rebellion was dropping out of Bronx High School, hiding a gun in his bureau, black jeans so tight he customized them with slits up the calf and could hardly walk up the five flights leading to our railroad apartment. With a police lock, the brick walls, the loft bed, the bathtub in the kitchen, where we lived in our shared rebellion. Our rebellion was his criminality, my welfare, our books and music, the dog he called Staggerly, nights in Tompkins Square Park, days on St. Mark's Place, armed love, cigarettes, leather jackets. My surrender was to heroin. His was to money. A baby born in the middle of the surrender, and his rebellion would be raves, speed, cars, girls, and survival. The drugs are gone. Staggerly was stolen from outside the bodega, and his owner's life surrendered to the gun held in his own hand. My rebellion is quiet and solitary. Broken down Tuesdays and hot summer days when life seems to go on too long. Today is Wednesday, July 4th. Fireworks, but no celebrations. I order Chinese food and search for a black and white movie. If new culture and tracks can be found, maybe there's still some hope for rebellion without surrender.
Nice.
Thank you. So what, should I read one more?
Yeah, let's do one more.
Oh, okay. This one I actually dedicate to Anthony Bourdain, mm-hmm. and it's called Anthony Bourdain, who I didn't know, but there's something about him that made me write this poem. It's called Used Car Love. You say you have a lot of love. I say I have a lot of cars and cheap hotel rooms. You had a few hotel rooms, but yours were classier, overlooking parks and mountains. Your love had views. My love had brick walls, Bukowski vibes, and stained towels. The cars were cleaner. I've always had a preference for two-door models, their sleek exterior and sneaky legroom. Lives lived on different planets, family dinner conversations and hieroglyphics. Love is a foreign country. Excavations, ridge walking, landing on Delancey, and in the end, I catch you alone. You seem smaller and a little scared, unprepared. For me, it doesn't matter. I've got a foothold on the other side, waiting on the corner in the dope dealer's boots. Buildings looming, even your vision is distorted. We live in shadows. You say you had a lot of love. I say I had a lot of cars. But don't pity me. I always like to drive.
Hmm.
That's the end.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
All right. It's been great talking to you.
Great talking to you, too. So hopefully I'll see you in September, and maybe we'll say, oh, okay, I remember you.
Yeah.
Could happen, right?
Could happen. Well, hopefully I'll be out there in November sometime. And
this November.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking. Oh, cool. That's what I'm thinking about, and hopefully set up some sort of anthology party, and we'll get to meet face-to-face again.
Oh, that's right. You did mention something. That. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool.
All right.
Yeah, my band will be doing something November 23rd. I'll send you an invite if you're there around that time.
Yeah, it's going to be earlier. It's going to have to.
Oh,
be,
okay.
It's going to be earlier.
Oh, well, I'll be around anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for inviting me to do this.
All right.
Looking forward to seeing you.
Yeah. You too. All right. Take care.
Okay. Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye.